Hi everyone, welcome to another episode of the Cheeky Natives. It's a boy, Letlokonolo. I'm running solo today because Dr. Slay is out slaying on a vacation. Today we're going to have a very interesting conversation, and I say interesting just because of the format in which it was written, the time in which it was written, the type of stories it transverses. But before I do that, I'm just going to, you know, read from, you know, we like reading blurbs, but I'm just going to read from the bio and then say hello to our guest, and then I'll read a bit about
the blurb. Interesting?
It does. We'll speak about the space too. Today we'll be talking to a writer, a multimedia, person, Phumlani Pikoli. Hi, Phumlani.
Hi.
How are you doing?
I'm okay. How are you?
I'm good. So, Phumlani is a multimedia journalist and a multi-skilled artist. He was born in Zimbabwe in 1988. This is his first time being published by an actual publishing house, and he intends to write and publish more books without restriction to form. Obviously, this was written when you published The Fatuous State of Severity the second time.
Yeah.
Right. The context is Phumlani published The Fatuous State of Severity as a self-published book, and then about a year or so later, it was published. But then, you know, as with always, he added a little bit more stories to, you know, make it seem different. But let me just read the blurb about The Fatuous State of Severity. The Fatuous State of Severity is a fresh collection of short stories and illustration that explore themes surrounding the experience of a generation of young, urban South African coping with tensions of social media, language insecurities, and relationships to various kinds. Intense and provocative, this new edition of the book, which was first published in 2016, features six additional stories, as well as an introductory essay on Phumlani Pikoli's publishing journey. So, I think let's start with this space, right? So we're doing this live recording conversation at the Tomorrow Gallery, where we're sitting literally in the, you know, the studio or the exhibition occupying the Fatuous State of Severity. Tell us about that. Like, how did the book become, you know, this visual representation of art?
I like your nails. Like, they look really fresh. When did you do them?
My nails?
Yeah.
A while ago.
Really? They look super fresh. You look like you just walked out of the bay right now. what's cool is that The Fatuous State of Severity was always a project that lent itself to different disciplines. And so the way in which it actually started was me voice noting my homie who was in America at the time. And yeah, I was in a psychiatric clinic and I was supposed to be journaling, and instead of that I decided to write the most ridiculous stories I could think of. And once I had sent that WhatsApp voice note to him, he told me, "Listen, motherfucker, I never want you to send me anything to read again that you've written. I just want you to read everything." So that developed, that idea gave some way to another idea, and then another homie was like, "Yo, can I illustrate to the story," which was Revenge, Scubalisto, and I was like, "Oh, damn, okay, cool, that gives it another layer." And then I made a short documentary thing that I put online. I made a short film for the stuff, and that lent itself to the ability to expand beyond the scope of just a book as well. And then the British Council, I went to them and I was like, "Yo, can you guys give me some space to talk about my publishing journey?" And they were like, "We need you to be a little bit more ambitious, because we'd like to give you money for like an idea that you could come up with." And that's how we're here, collaborating with different artists within the virtual and augmented reality space. So just a bunch of, I was just taking chances and somehow they paid off.
You spoke a bit about it when you answered the question. So you say this in the introductory essay of this edition of The Fatuous State of Severity. You say, you know, The Fatuous State of Severity was a space you occupied when you were, you know, healing from a depressive episode in a psychiatric clinic. Talk to us a bit about that. like, just, you know, it's not cathartic, but, you know, instead of journaling, you said you wrote these stories that then became the Fatuous State.
So that was the wild thing that, because it was the first time, I think, in years that I really started writing from a place of just writing for myself. The journal, the journaling space that I was afforded in the psychiatric clinic made it that much easier, because also when you're in a psychiatric clinic, you've got different barriers that you don't have to deal with in normal life. You don't have to worry about cleaning. You don't have to worry about what's going to be up for supper tonight. You don't have to worry about rent. You don't have to worry about getting back to your bed and it's not made. Also, you're doing intensive therapy, from group therapy to individual psychiatry. Like, you've got all these things that are so focused on yourself that it's a really cool place to then tap into perhaps what you really do love, and explore that. So for the first time, I just wasn't writing about for money, and I wasn't writing for an audience. I was just writing for myself and just let myself loose, and people enjoy that.
I want to speak a bit about privilege, right? You were in the psychiatric hospital where you didn't have to think about all these things, right? And I want to speak about, you know, in some ways it's a privilege that not a lot of people in South Africa are able to afford, right? The privilege to actually take some time out of your life and let's say, find yourself or try and find yourself. Mm. Do you want to talk a bit about, like, that privilege?
Yeah, that was, it was super crazy. I was also lucky to be in a position where I could actually afford to do that. So a lot of people don't know that medical aid, especially, well, I was on Discovery at the time, allows you 15 outpatient sessions with a psychologist and then 21 days inpatient treatment. So that's a prescribed minimum benefit. They have to pay for that. And because at the time, beginnings to grow in popularity, the conversation around mental health was sort of limited and people weren't actually looking at those sorts of things. But also, I was also in a space at work where I could go and actually say that and say, listen, leave me the fuck alone for 3 weeks. I'm treating myself for, you know, depression and anxiety. But yeah, where privilege does kick in is, you know, those ideas that I had a steady job, and that I was on medical aid. And what was super interesting was the amount of people who were in there as well who didn't have privileged backgrounds as I do, like coming from suburban Pretoria. I've had the luck and opportunity to be able to be in therapy from the age of 7 throughout my life. Who were for the first time actually navigating the idea of taking time out for themselves to think more deeply about how they've been affected by a lot of things in the world. And the second part was, what was most interesting, I think, was how many black women who had checked in for all these things that they're supposed to be doing were just like, fuck that, I'm going to sleep for 3 weeks. And they literally didn't leave their beds. They just slept. And that fatigue, like that level of fatigue for me was such a interesting sort of irony, because it, you know, you're being given space to sort of develop yourself, but people actually just want to fucking rest. Like, people are just tired. So the other interesting thing I found was SADAG had done a survey where they found out that most black people who go for just regular checkups with a doctor, I think it's like 58% or something, actually also present with depressive symptoms. But because of cultural influence and stigma and societal value, no one actually takes that seriously, because only white people can afford the time to think about how they feel about the world.
I also think that's like quite a large occupation of the stories that you write in your short story collection. Just the idea of navigating, you know, blackness, right? Mm. And navigating the idea of, let's call it a white illness, right?
Yeah.
And the idea that you can take time out. Because, I mean, what does it mean to take time out from living, right?
Yeah.
But why was it important for you to, you know, transverse that in your stories? The idea that, like, you know, we're human first, right? Like, blackness is an integral part of who we are, but, like, we suffer from depression. And how was it for you navigating that space, right? Or was there, or did the class privilege, which is the suburban Praetorian life, you know, sort of create or carve out a space for you where you were able to be like, okay, my parents understand that life is hard and therefore I need this, as opposed to them being like, what white illness is this? Why do you have time for white illnesses?
Well, I think my parents set themselves up in a very, very different sort of way that a lot of other black families I've experienced do. One was to inculcate from a very young age that their children had to think, which put them in the ass, because then, you know, we'd be responding to very irrational demands with, but why? And then your mom is just like, I'm not here for a dialogue or a debate. And it's like, yeah, but this is your fault. But like, I was also super lucky because my parents, my mom forced me into occupational therapy. Well, not forced me. She put me into occupational therapy because I was dyslexic, which was the first time that I had a space where I had an adult that I could speak to as like a person. Because, I mean, in school, you've still got this teacher authority paternal relationship going on with your teachers. So it was for the first time where someone cared about how I felt and how I was existing in the world. And from an eye level, you know, not from a looking down at you. And so from that, I had to go through behavioral therapy when I was a teenager, because I was low-key a delinquent. I think that's the official term. I was smoking weed, I was bunking class, I was, you know, hanging with all the people that you're not supposed to hang with. And, you know, from there, the progress into realizing or accepting that I was actually depressed as a human being, I think was an easier leap to make for my parents, because obviously I had child psychologists from such a young age that it was easy to do that. And so having to experiencing that and layering it with this blackness, but this also othered idea of blackness, which is the suburban Pretoria that you're thinking about, and it could be suburban anywhere really, really then sort of became hard, because now you're trying to traverse two worlds, one being cultural and almost presented as a bygone era from what you can understand of it, versus the other being the present and futuristic, which is Western inculcated values and worldviews. And so between that duality, you've got to reconcile yourself into existing as a human being. And that's why the way in which I construct most of my characters in the stories is having the sort of tension of complete existence. Not simply from one world or the other, but within a framework of the South African imagination, which absolutely makes no sense at this point in time.
I mean, one thing that I'm interested about, or one thing that both Alma and I really enjoyed, is the form, right? The form is really magnificent, right? I'm really, like, fascinated about form. I just think that often when we speak to black writers, we don't speak about the form in which they choose to employ. There are sort of interludes or breaks between the book, right? Was that intentional?
I don't know if it was intentional so much as it just played out the way it did. Especially when we were coming through the second time with adding six more stories and the introduction, then that became a lot more structured and sort of formalized. But in terms of form, I don't think that there was this like predicated idea that we need to give people breaks.
Yeah, because I mean, the heaviness of the book, right? Sort of for me reading, it's like, okay, you're like, it's like, pace yourself, right? It's just like, take a breather here if you need to. Look at this illustration just to take a breather. And I'm wondering if, maybe not consciously, but because of the type of care work that you're trying to do with the book, it played itself out that way.
I think it just organically played itself out that way, especially because I was working, I mean, by the time I started putting the book together in its first iteration in 2016, I had collaborated with different artists that I really, really enjoy and different people whose minds I thought would really, really be able to apply themselves to the work that I had done. So I think the form came out quite organically, and I think Pan saw that as well.
Yeah.
I think Pan saw that opportunity to then actually formalize that form, which was sort of pre-existing.
I mean, I want to talk a bit about some of the themes that I thought were quite prevalent and really delicious for me. The first story is about these two brothers, right? But for me, I thought about like, just, yeah, and you know, we're like looking at them, like I'll post a picture when the podcast is out and then, you know, you'll see these pictures that I'm talking about. But for me, what is fascinating was we don't talk in this urban, you know, generation about male intimacy, right? Particularly in the way that the stories plays itself out. And I wanted to know, like, what was it that you're trying to tease out in particularly looking at, like, male intimacy? Because the story is quite intimate in this older brother, like, really caring for the younger brother, but not in a sibling capacity, as in, like, I'm your keeper, and I need to make sure that you're okay because I'm your keeper. In the same way that the little brother is like, I'm your keeper.
Yeah, that one was actually super interesting. I'd written that outside, and then I included it within the stories, and that's how we open up the book as the first story, just to, you know, trap you motherfuckers in, like, think that it's safe. My beautiful little boy was something that I shared with a friend, and he was like, you know, the story, like, I love it, it's beautiful, but there's a very big part of it that makes me a little bit uncomfortable, especially because of the sort of spatial and the touch relation, the relationship of intimate touch between two men. Even though there's nothing sinister about it, it's just not normalized and it's just not seen. And even I, while I was writing it, was like, wait, okay, this is also a new terrain, because I can imagine the way that I wish that my older brother had treated me or had interacted with me, and also to know and feel that you can be intimate with an older male figure that's not sinister. So
especially in this world, right?
Especially in this world. And I think also even as black parents, a lot of black parents, even mothers, are sort of emotionally unavailable quite a lot, and simply, and that's just a byproduct of colonial apartheid, right? Because people have to work. And so they don't really get that much time to spend with the child. And by 3 or 4 years old, the kid needs to know what's going on in the world and the reality of it. Whereas white kids get to be white kids for as long as then their parents decide at 21, okay, cool, this is where you need to be going.
They can come back, right?
Yeah, I mean, listen, colonialism is a wonderful thing. You reap benefits that you never had to sow.
So I want you to read just a little bit of beautiful little boy. Okay. Just the first paragraph, because I like the inviting in, right? I felt like you're just like, you are safe here. Yeah. And I feel like I want, you know, our listeners to just hear the safety.
Okay. Buti, are we really so special? I asked my older brother as he held my hand and guided me across the road. Of course we are, he said as we stepped onto the pavement on the other side. He looked down at me and touched the back of my head. He knew I really liked it when he put his hand at the back of my head. His hands felt soft on my head and hard on my hands. I felt myself shiver with joy, and he laughed.
Can you just feel the intimacy? But, like, not the intimacy of the way in which when we read that story, we'd understand what the story is, right? Mm. It's just like there's this tenderness with which I love it when he holds my hand a certain way, right? Mm. And in the same way, I think, like, in some ways, the fatuous is that. It's like, I'm here to hold space for you because I've been in this situation and I want to, you know, to talk through it. A large preoccupation of the fatuous is also this digital world, right? We live in this social media age and like, oh my gosh, like I gotta tell people, I'm here, I'm doing this. And a large part of it for me, like, was like the confidence that is attached to a like, a retweet, you know, a share, a comment. And I wanted to know why it was important for you in exploring the lives of urban young South Africans, particularly black in this instance, why it was important for you to bring the digital element in, and why it was important for you to speak about, particularly, like, you know, in the one story, there's this person who's literally going onto a Instagram, and it's like, and in some instances, it's like, I'm going to delete this photo because it's not doing as well as it should be. So why was it important for you to explore that element?
We're taking a short break.
Are you a Caribbean American? Are you looking for a podcast that truly speaks to your culture and identity? Look no further than Carry On Friends, the ultimate destination for all things Caribbean American, hosted by me, Carrie Ann. Dive deep into topics such as culture, heritage, and everyday life through the unique lens of the Caribbean American experience. You'll walk away feeling more connected to your roots. Follow and listen on Apple Podcasts so you'll never miss an episode of Carry On Friends, the Caribbean American experience. Your Caribbean American community awaits.
So I think there were two things here. One, at the time that I had written it, there was a much bigger expression of class division through digital media. And how that sort of unfolds is quite often that people who've been on the internet for a very long time, prior, the big social medias of Facebook and all of that, then you've got like this MySpace generation, and prior to that there was
MIX33.
Yeah, exactly. Like, but also even under MIX33 there were these sort of message boards where South African people would come, if you had a internet dial-up connection, then Africa's Gateway, where everyone was talking about music, and where a lot of artists, actually, a lot of musical artists that people were into, and even this was actually marked by class because it was almost abstract. I want to say African Dope Records, but it wasn't abstract. It was just slightly left of center, and even there was like this crazy class distinction of, if you're going to make art, don't make art for commercial purposes. Make art for being true to yourself and expressing yourself. And that in itself is an expression of people who actually have time to sort of do this, and they don't need to make it a career, you know? So I think there's a lot of sort of space within the digital era that people sort of kind of dismiss, and especially within South African culture, that they dismiss because they weren't there. So, you know, like how a kid is when they think if they weren't at a place, something didn't happen, because nothing can happen around the world without them being present. So there was definitely that, because a lot of even, you know, middle class black kids, internet was a luxury. You had to have the Pentium 4 before you could access that. So there's very stratified, intentional class purposes and ways in which people interact with the relationship that I think are being sort of peeled back now, but at the same time reinforcing the same sort of tropes that you know, we don't understand the language of digital. And then the second part was purely psychological, and the way that influences self-esteem and understanding importance through digital validation, knowing that if your post got shared like 15 times, oh boy, you're doing something. Oh, if it got shared 100 times, woof, you're live. 400, come on, you know. But also there's a distinct appreciation of internet culture here, in the same way that there's a distinct appreciation culture outside of South Africa. And so for me, it was about locating the sort of global medium within the context of, you know, the southern tip, which is a very interesting space on its own.
I just want to say, for, you know, our podcast listeners, just a trigger warning, we're going to talk about, like, you know, some mental health right now. So if you want to take some space just to stop the podcast, you're happy to do that. And then maybe resume when it's okay to do so. We understand that this could be a very triggering moment for you. But I want to talk about, like, I suppose the essence of the fatuous state of severity, right? That we live in this world where there's a lot of mental illness going on. I mean, one of the stories that really, like, touched me was a story about suicide, right? And about, like, this premeditation, right? That sometimes we are preoccupied with death, that we actually plan to kill ourselves. Whether it happens in the end or not, like, it's something that we have, like, suicide ideations or a thing. And I wanted to talk about that, right? Like, you know, having struggling with mental health, right? Like, talk to us a bit about that.
So there's a very interesting thing that happens when we speak about suicide, I think. There's a number of issues surrounding it. And most of them are moral-based, and most of that morality is steeped within religious or spiritual sort of understanding and framing. But then you also get different parts of the world that look at suicide as, you know, a natural relief of burden to life, because some people are just completely fatigued by the idea of life, and they make space for that. So I was listening to, or did I see on Twitter, I think it was Sean Ferguson. Yeah, I think it was Sean Ferguson. She was writing on Twitter about, you know, she had these ideas of suicide, and they just wouldn't stop. She'd be walking somewhere and she'd see oncoming traffic and would think about jumping into the next car, or if she was in a building, she would then, like, suddenly think, yo, maybe I should just jump off, all of that. And then she realized, after going to therapy, that these are actually just intrusive thoughts. They're not ideations around suicide. So that for me was super interesting to also look at and hear. Then, you know, then there's the suicidal depressive who, you know, who's constantly seeking out this relief of the burden of life. And so that's what I found interesting about the story To Shy Away in Silence, is I was writing it initially, what I I'd set out to do was write a dark comedy about this dude who wants to commit suicide, but he just keeps getting it wrong, and he just keeps failing at it. And then just ending up in this space where it's just like, ah, fuck, I feel so useless. But then it became a little bit more sincere as I started rapping, unraveling this character and seeing what the character was sort of living through and where they were living and what kind of friends this character had around them or whatever, because it's a nameless character. And, you know, if I were to be 100 about it, they also genderless. There's no referral to their gender at all.
What's really interesting, though, is there's a line in the story where you say, you know, oftentimes suicide is very gendered, right?
Yeah.
So when you think about people who are socialized as women, they've had too much blood in their lifetimes, so their suicides would not be bloody. You know, and I thought that was like because I thought about my friends, right, who have died by suicide, and the women, like, have either hung themselves or they've, you know, taken pills, but it's never been like slitting wrists or stuff like that. And I was like, actually, that's like an astute observation.
Well, it was an idea that I actually picked up from a friend of mine who said, you know, women are considerate in the way that they kill themselves because they've been cleaning blood for so long that they know the mess that they'd be leaving behind for someone else to clean up. So that was, and that had stuck with me for a while, and I'd always been waiting to sort of use that idea and put it into the world to actually then have it explored a little bit, because then we have to look at the relationship between blood and violence and, you know, the idea of who, naturally bleeds and is inherently introverted just by purpose of the world, and who seeks out blood by, you know, through force. Outside of, you know, natural interpretation and movement. And so I just thought that it was a really fun sort of position to be in, to actually leave that question hanging, just to put the idea forth and see what happens with it.
I mean, this could be a complete imposition of my reading of your work and of this particular work, but I thought there was quite a large disruptiveness around sexual norms, right? In certain instances, I thought there was a queerifying of like relations in the story. And I want to talk a bit about that, right? Talk about the idea that in certain instances, there seems to be some like what people would perceive homoerotic relations. Is it that, or am I too queer to be like, okay, I can see what's going on here?
Well, I think there were definitely attempts at sexuality disruptions and not to have this sort of binary scale of heteronormative constructions of character. But at the same time, I couldn't dig too deep within that because it's not the space that I occupy as a human, and so I didn't want it to be voyeuristic. So I used it more as an ironic flippancy towards sexuality. So even in To Shy Away in Silence, the character gets told, you need to fuck or be fucked, you know? And in Tumblr, you know, this dude is trying to get with this chick. Yeah. And then she tells him, like, no, literally go fuck yourself and then maybe I'll consider.
Does, right?
And he literally fucks himself and, you know, and then she rams the dildo up his ass and he, like, lies in a pool of cum and says pussy is so gay, you know. So there were definitely ironic flippancies that I wanted to impose on a cultural norm of heteronormative heteropatriarchal structure.
And I'm wondering, even to shine silence, right, whether the two characters were feeling each other in some ways. Because I felt there were moments where I'm like, I wonder if these two people have been together, right? But I suppose that's what you're saying, right? It's just posting the idea, yeah, and being like, do with this what you will, right?
Yeah.
But more broadly, I think you also, another aspect is talking about mental health and sexuality, right? And the idea of being sexual while you are in this state. And, you know, I want to talk a bit about that. Like, do you think that feeling depressive or being in a depressed state impacts the way that you can exercise intimacy?
Yeah, I definitely think it can, especially because there's a lot that you're not supposed to be feeling or you're not supposed to be expressing in the way that you're feeling. And one of the greatest cultural taboos we have in South Africa is sexuality. And so looking towards expressing that within a space that you're not supposed to outwardly state to people, then I think raises broader questions, raises broader internal questions with one's own relationship with sexuality. So, with the fatuous state of severity, I was just trying to write the naughtiest and the most ridiculous stories that I could think of, and that even speaks to what's going on with me, you know? Like, I'm saying that I was writing the most ridiculous stories, and that could be invalidating some of my characters, which is not the case intentionally, but it is sort of the beginning of an exploration of norms and ideas that I haven't had to occupy before.
Do you have a favorite story? Do you have this is like the epitome of the fatuous?
I do have a favorite story.
Which one is it?
No one likes the story. And it's weird. It's weird, like all the stories that I worked, like that felt like labor,
yeah,
everybody loves.
Yeah.
Like everybody loves.
Yeah.
But the one story that came to me and that I wrote in, like, I don't know, 4 hours through tears,
yeah,
is the one story that nobody seems to like. It's called Pico.
I mean, truth, I sort of struggled with it. I don't know, because I think it's also the uncomfortability. I think that we, as a people, and I think what the fatuous does, right, is that it invites us to sit with uncomfortability and be comfortable in the uncomfortability. And so Beagle for me felt uncomfortable. And but I sat in it, you know. And in truth, I feel like I can understand why people don't like it. But I can understand why you like it, because this is your baby, you birthed it, right? And for you, it could have been a cathartic, I'm releasing, right? And for us, it's like, my beautiful little boy is like, ah, so warm and fuzzy, right? To shy away from the silence is so, like, gripping. But, yeah, so I hear you.
Yeah, I think also the other big thing about what makes Pico, because a lot of people have said it's actually quite confusing, which has been cool to me, because also then when I shared it with intimate friends, they were like, oh fuck, yeah, cool. Like a friend of mine was just like, I sent it to him via mail and he just responded, dude, I can't say anymore, but I think this is the greatest thing I've ever read you write. So Biko, I think because Biko is so layered and there are so many timelines going on, and different mind states being occupied,
yeah,
it becomes this like really, really sort of overlayered story about a dude losing his mind on a beach.
But I suppose in a way it's the epitome, right, of occupying this space where you're neither here nor there, or past, present, future, anxiety, depression, mental health, I need to live, I need to be good. So in a way, like, Beagle for me felt like that. And I think that's why it was uncomfortable, because I was just like, oh my gosh, like, why is so much happening? And no, like, I don't want so much to be happening, because in some ways it's like a window into my mind. And I was just like, I don't need to go into this window.
Well, and that was the fun part about it, because I was actually trying to explore how fast actually everything happens, how fast your mind actually moves, and like how little we take time to process what it is, because it's also this dude on a beach in Mozambique who's feeling like super, like for some reason he feels unnerved and unsettled, and he just can't reconcile his own physical sensations to the sort of feeling. He's got like a gut feeling that he's also not understanding. Three, he is completely tripping out and being immersed into, or being pulled into, a world that he can't imagine that he's understanding. And then four is this completely intrusive memory that refuses to leave him alone, you know? And then he's got all these friends around him who are trying to make him present.
Yeah.
But in the present, he's unable to occupy the present because of everything. Like, he's physically uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And that physical discomfort manifests into him thinking of himself as something else.
Yeah.
So, yeah, like, what I liked about Biko is just actually how fast everything happens. Because I can't imagine that story taking place over more than 10 minutes.
Yeah, but what I didn't like about Biko is how fast it was, right? So, like, in many ways, it was just like, oh, wait, hold up. Like, this is, like, the precision of what happens in certain instances, and I'm not ready to confront that.
Yeah.
Do you think that The Fatuous has done for you what you wanted to do in the world?
Good question.
I suppose the precursor to that question would be this, right? What, when you wrote The Fatuous, or when you released it, right, what did you want it to do? And then, connected to that, has it done that?
I think I keep actually saying to people that I feel like this book is the little engine that could. In that it just has kept on going. You know, the little engine was never expected to, you know, carry on climbing higher and higher and higher. And I had no, like, I could never imagine that this is where I'd be almost 4 years later with this little thing that I used my rent money to sort of, like, you know, invest in.
Yeah.
And have it be here to the point where it's got a whole exhibition. So The Fatuous State of Severity for me was just it was a lucky break, and a beautiful one at that.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, obviously now we're sitting, and you've not only written The Fatuous State, you've also written a novel. Tell us a bit about, like, the divide between writing The Fatuous State of Severity and The Born Freeloaders, like novel versus a short story collection.
Yeah, my publisher actually, when I showed her like half a manuscript and whatever, she asked me, do you actually want to write a novel? And I was like, yeah, I do. Because the novel is one sort of story where you get to actually play with form. You get to play around with, you know, spatial ideas, you know, the verisimilitude of the world that you've actually created, which is, you know, the veracity for which people can sort of have to explore the depth of each character. So you've got more time on doing that. And I think I really, really enjoyed that, because I had to chill with these characters. Whereas short stories, I can literally, like, write and then check out, because it's just the one situation.
And do you think the one medium is more difficult than the other? Because, I mean, we know in South Africa, right, in the literature space, the short story collection is a really underrated story form, and often very difficult, because you have to have a start, middle, and finish, but also be impactful, also have a full story, right?
Yeah.
Where a novel, in some instances, as you've said, gives you a new way to tell a story, which more often than not can be a linear story, right? So do you think one is more difficult than the other?
I think they both occupy different spaces.
Mm-hmm.
So for instance, right now, I can't imagine myself writing another collection of short stories, but I can imagine myself writing another novel.
Yeah.
And so I think for me, it's about feeling. And right now, I'm in this space where I feel like I want to look at characters extended beyond just one sort of frame.
But you know what's interesting is, like, I've been reading a lot of, like, short story collections where, like, writers do this amazing thing where it's short stories, but the stories all connect. And in The Fatuous, there's that as well, right? Like, you read this one story and you read this other story, and you're like, oh, wait, hold up. Like, this is a thing, right? So maybe thinking about that, right? So thinking about the exploration of characters in short form as opposed to in character development on a longer novel form.
Mm. Well, I think what I did with The Fatuous State of Severity in terms of leaving, like, really minor characters in different stories where you actually get to explore them a little bit more in others, was I was actually just playing around with the idea of leaving Easter eggs, so and also, you know, creating a world in which these characters could exist. So for me, it really was about so if The Fatuous State of Severity was a universe, what would the planets be? And so I tried to put those planets in order and let people know, okay, gravity doesn't exist here. This one has, like, four moons. This one has two suns. And this is how they, like, hop between each other, kind of thing.
I mean, the truth is, I think that The Fatuous State is one of its kind. I haven't read A Fatuous State of Severity in a South African context. And by that I mean, like, we tend to shy away from the very difficult conversations of mental health, right? And how mental health impacts our lives. Or to tend to shy away about the impact of, like, a social media as a contributor to mental health, right? So when I say the first of its kind, and I think it's really allowed us to, you know, a springboard for conversations about, why do you actually want people to like your status? Like, what is the very purpose of that? Like, why? Why do you share a photo? Is it because you want people to see, or you want people to like? Like, what is that? So thank you for that. Thank you for the mind. You know, sometimes, because I also think that what we tend to do with artists who are depressed, who, you know, occupy mental health, we tend to make them these, like, sideline geniuses. I think often of how people talk about Sello Dacre, right? Like, not thinking about his genius as a person, and, like, just thinking about this person existing as a genius and not being a crazy genius, but literally just a genius, right?
Yeah. And I mean, and he does that in his work, where he constantly shows people, like, yo, like, because for me, with Sello Dacre at the moment, I'm starting to read him a little bit differently than what I read him when I was in varsity. Yeah. And when I was in varsity, I was like, oh my gosh, he's, like, exploring all sorts of, like, you know, social taboos, and, you know, he's also doing this thing with sexuality, where no black man in South Africa was, like, not... They weren't even touching it.
In fiction,
yeah. And I remember my lecturer was like, yo, this is not, Sello Dacre is not the first black man to write about, you know, homosexuality. Yeah. You should read Another Country by James Baldwin.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah. Or
Giovanni's Room, but, like.
Well, I mean, Another Country was super interesting because of the way that it followed different characters and different structures. And I think that's what spoke to Quiet Violence, is that because there's different characters, constantly going,
but I mean,
and different modes and expressions.
I mean, I'm a Baldwin knight, so, like, you've opened, like, a little can of worms. But I think even when we think about Baldwin's first novel, right, Go Tell It to the Mountain, the underpinnings of Go Tell It to the Mountain is thinking very subtly about sexuality. Giovanni's Room is a little bit more express because it is about that. And yes, when we think about Another Country, we think about the layer in which it's done. In similar ways to the way The Quiet Violence of Dreams does, right?
Yeah. No, definitely. I think Go Tell It on the Mountain was very it was cool because it was rooted within the confines of sort of, you know, religious repression. But the other thing that I really liked about Dacre is the brash manner in which he also attacked these subjects. It was a very, in a time where respectability politics within black homes and cultures was everything prior to Julius Malema's rise within like the political sphere. It was very in your face, fuck you, this is what I am.
It was crude, right?
Yeah.
I think about 13 Cents in particular.
Yeah.
And I think about 13 Cents being that, like, in your face, this is what is happening, yeah, this is the reality.
I mean, even Quiet Violence, I mean, shit, there's a point where, you know, he's, like, talking about how, you know, Zeb was actually the dude who raped his mom, and then he, like, with the blood, like, on his dick, forced him to give him head, and, like, this all happened when he was a kid, you know? Like, and it's just like, Jesus, dude, like, what the fuck is going on at home?
Me, like, I'm just like, genius, right? I'm like, for me, like, after reading The Fatuous State, right, I'm just like, I would like to live in your mind, right? Because I want to know what happens in your mind. Because, like, how do these things come together? How, like, writers for me are like that. I'm just like, I just want to spend a moment in your mind so that I can figure out, like, how can your mind produce this, right? Like, what must be going on?
Well, and that's why I think I've started reading Cello a little bit more, a little differently at the moment. Because I think more than anything, what Q was, and this is just how I feel at this time, and I could change my mind, but the more I think about his books, the more I feel that what he was actually uncovering under the layer of violence was a really big survivor's guilt. I mean, we're talking to someone who went to Redham, you know. Is it Redham or Red Hill?
Red Hill.
And it's like, and especially at its time, it was one of the most expensive schools in the country.
Yeah.
And then to sort of have, and then they go to Rhodes. He goes to Rhodes, and, you know, so there's all these sort of, and especially at the time when we think about it, like, I mean, this is like, what, early 2000s?
And Cape Town,
and,
right?
Yeah.
And just Cape Town, because I feel most strongly that comes out in his work is just the violence of Cape Town, right?
Yeah.
And so I appreciate that, because, like, I've always read his work, for me, the underpinnings of, like, what is this life? The actual life of this writer, and how does this impact his writing? Right?
Yeah, and I think, you know, when we come back to this idea of romanticizing artists with mental illness, is I think we're sort of lucky in the day and age that we live because of the myth busting that's going on, versus the glamorization and the romanticism that could have happened in his time, and especially as a black exotic speaking about taboos and then just being this literary, like, sort of poster boy for, you know, don't give a fuck blackness, you know? So I think Cello is quite... I think he's still speaking loudly from the other side.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I also think that, in truth, we haven't begun to speak about the legacy of Cello and what Cello has made possible in your own writing and makes possible in many other people's writing.
Yeah.
What is next for Pumlani? So you've gotten this Fatuous State of Severity. We are at this beautiful exhibition. You've written a novel. What more can we expect from you?
Ooh, I guess more art, more things. Yeah, I just want to carry on making stuff. In the words of Spike Jones, if I feel something, I want to find the best medium to express it.
And are we going to get more of what we were exposed to in the Fatuous State?
I don't know if there's going to be... I don't know if there's going to be anything I've replicated. But I think there's this crazy closer greeting that I heard the other day, and I still can't get it out of my mind. It was actually in conversation over New Year's. And I'm still waiting to bump into someone who like actually is familiar with it. But it says kula sekboni. Essentially saying, you know, you've grown up so much that we can barely see the child in you. Mm. Or just keep going. You're doing a great job.
Yeah.
I just wanna grow as an artist, and if there's echoes of sentiments in the work, at least I'll be able to big up young me.
Yeah.
I'm not completely sure about what's next, although I am excited about the prospect of what could be next.
Yeah. And if people love this podcast and want to follow you on social media, what do they do?
Scout Gumby on Twitter and Instagram, SCOUTGUMBE.
And do you want them to like your posts?
Hey man, listen, buy the book, burn it on social media. I need the EFF to give me a little bit more clout and for the books to sell.
Thank you very much, Pumlani. As I said, we at the Cheeky Natives have really appreciated the Fatuous State of Severity.
Thank you so much for having me, finally.
And to our listeners, until next time, goodbye.